Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org. Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, where visitors can experience campus and learn about Luther's 60-plus academic programs, like engineering science, nursing, and music education. luther.edu/visit.
Turning our attention now to a very serious topic because it impacts so many people in our state. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and statistically, we all know victims and survivors of this horrible and preventable crime. Patty Seeger is the executive director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She's been working in the domestic abuse field in Wisconsin for many a year now. And Patty, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for covering this topic.
It's a tough topic. And just as I want to address our listeners for just a minute, you may be a survivor of domestic abuse. What would you like others in that situation to know? Or are you worried about someone you think is in an abusive relationship and you want to help? Patty certainly has advice on how to best support the people that you care about. So I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And as I said, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Patty, how prevalent is it nationwide?
Well, depending on the study that's out, we know that between 1 in 4 and 1 in 3 women are victimized and 1 in 10 men are victimized by domestic violence. It's very prevalent, somewhere between 2 and 4 million people annually across the nation. We serve in Wisconsin through the local domestic violence program network in Wisconsin, serves more than 40,000 women, men, and children annually. Which is quite high.
That's a lot of people.
In single-day census, we every year conduct a census, a 24-hour census, so we get an unduplicated count in one day. And depending on the year, somewhere between 1,500 and 1,700 people in Wisconsin are seeking services.
Oh, boy. And you have you just handed me a report here, Wisconsin Domestic Violence Homicide Report for 2011 and 2012. It's published this fall, and it's 59 pages long.
Right, right. In that report, which is also available as a free download on our website, www.endabusewi.org, you can find it under What We Do, Homicide Reports. We try to publish in very brief detail the story of each person who was killed as a result of domestic violence in Wisconsin in a given year. This report covers the years 2011 and 2012. There were 37 deaths in 2011 and 52 in 2012. Our report not only documents the lives and death of the perpetrator and the direct victim, but we try to also talk about others who are killed as a result of domestic violence. For example, today is the one-year anniversary of the Ozana Spa shooting in Brookfield, Wisconsin. And there were, not only was Zena Houghton killed, she was the intended victim of her husband, but he also killed three others in that shooting.
Yeah, and wounded another three or four
yes,
others,
yes, others
as well.
As
so
well.
It's just a terrible, terrible situation. And I'm wondering, does it happen in more in some groups or communities than others? Is it spread across demographic lines? Is it?
Sure. That's a really good question. Domestic violence happens in all communities, all cultures, all races and ethnicities, all religious groups, all education levels, all income levels. I think that sometimes people view it more as a low-income issue rather than people who are higher income. But statistically, we know that it does occur across all groups. And what I think the key difference is with low-income people is they tend to live in more dense housing with closer neighbors, and police are much more likely to be called by a neighbor or be patrolling in those neighborhoods than they are. And, you know, you're
more affluent.
Fancy, affluent neighborhoods with large yards and big houses and a lot of distance between them. So we don't see as many cases that have law enforcement contact coming out of more affluent neighborhoods. But it doesn't mean that domestic violence doesn't exist there.
And the violence, obviously, that is the main concern. I would never want to diminish that. But it has an economic impact as well.
Huge economic impact. We know that there are many days lost to sick time for employees who've been battered. We know that there's often a health care cost. In fact, the Affordable Care Act that is being implemented now includes screening for domestic abuse. It's the first time we have a national health care policy that requires that health care providers be screening for domestic abuse, and that's a reimbursable cost to health insurance companies. So we know that there's health care costs. We know that there's missed work cost, and certainly the human cost, you know, of what happens. Children are frequently present and witness it. Their school lives and are disrupted often. Families may go homeless. The number one cause of homelessness for women with children in the United States of America is domestic violence, and that they're fleeing an abusive relationship.
Mm. Talking today with Patty Seeger, who is the executive director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, and callers online, you can join in, by the way, too, at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Ruth in Madison with us by phone. Ruth, thank you for calling. Hello.
Well, thank you for taking this, and thanks for doing this topic. Back in 1988, I went homeless for 6 months to get out of a relationship with where I was battered. And the reason I had to go homeless was because I couldn't get on another lease. So even though I was paying half the rent where I was living with him, I could afford to get a place with somebody else, except that nobody would let me sign a lease, because once you're on a lease, you know, they'll say, well, you know, unless you can afford to buy the place outright, like your last name is Kennedy or something. And so I couldn't get on a lease or a mortgage anywhere else. And the day my lease expired, I closed on a house and was able to move in. But in the interim, I was homeless for 6 months. But I wanted to say that a lot of times people will get really, you know, huffy about, you know, when he finds you again and then you have to take him back in. Well, why did she take him back in? Well, it has to do with that statistically you're most likely to get killed while you were in the act of leaving. So if he knocks on your door and you walk past him and leave again, that's most likely when you're going to die. And so you have no choice but to take him in and try and find another time when you can safely leave.
Hmm. Thanks for telling us your story, Ruth. And Patty, your comments.
Thanks, Ruth. You know, your story is not uncommon. There are many victims of abuse who've experienced the exact same thing as you. Several years ago, my organization was successful in passing a law in Wisconsin that allows victims of both domestic violence and sexual assault to terminate their lease with their landlord. And it's only 4 or so years old now. But we continue to be challenged. Housing is a huge challenge for victims of domestic violence. I want to be clear about that. We have a housing law that's been making its way through the Wisconsin legislature that has raised a number of concerns for us, and we've been able to successfully insert language that would have landlords address domestic abuse somewhat, but there's a law that would allow landlords to evict tenants based upon calling police, which is something that victims of domestic violence, quite honestly, may need to do. I also want to address what Ruth raised, is that leaving is a dangerous time for victims. You know, it's very easy for people in our society to say that, you know, if this person is unsafe or doesn't like the abuse, they should just leave. But leaving is a complex, what Ruth points out is it's a complex proposition for many victims. And it's not always easy. It is indeed the one of the trigger points in which many victims may be killed. That being said, I want to be really cautious about that because, as I said, local programs throughout Wisconsin served have annually served more than 40,000 a year, and many of those are people who are leaving who do get out safely. And it's my personal opinion that 37 deaths in 2011, 52 in 2012 are way too many. Way too many. Every life lost is one life too many.
One is too many.
So, but that we know from documentation that many of those victims were attempting to leave. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, the case we talked about, the Zana Spa shooting, Zena Houghton had just applied for a restraining order and obtained a restraining order against her estranged husband. And she was letting him know, he was put on notice that she was leaving. And that is one of those examples.
Ruth, thank you.
Thank you, Ruth.
I very much appreciate your call. Jeanette in Waukesha, I want to give you a chance, but I'm telling you, I tell you what, I hope you'll stay with us because we're coming up on a news break, and I want to give you the time that it may deserve. So I hope you'll please stay with us online. George grew up in a violent home where his father abused his mother. At 64, he still thinks about it and made it challenging to be a healthy parent himself. You know, so he wants people to know that children are very much impacted by growing up in a violent home. And I think, obviously, that is something that you would never forget as a child.
Absolutely not. And, you know, the thing is, you know, children have different levels of resilience. And I think building the resilience in children is very key to helping small children and actually children throughout the entire lifespan learn how to endure and survive abusive relationships.
We'll talk some more about that. And Jeanette and Keith, I'm waiting online. We'll certainly get to you. So I hope you'll stay with us. Patty Seeger, our guest, Executive Director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll be back with our guest right after this look at the news. As we raise our children, most of us, I think, dream of them leading happy and successful lives. The last thing we want to imagine is for them to be involved in an abusive relationship, whether it's as the victim or the perpetrator, as a matter of fact. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, taking a look at both what resources are available and how you and I can help to end this tragedy in our society. Patty Seeger, our guest, she's the Executive Director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She has worked in the domestic abuse field for many years. And Patty, again, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It very
and thank
much.
You.
And you were saying earlier, just for those who are maybe just tuning in, there's something like 40,000 people affected.
Yeah, more than 40,000 a year seek services in Wisconsin. I believe there's, you know, hundreds of thousands, potentially more victims who aren't reaching out to services. I think it's worth noting that in Wisconsin, there are 72 counties and 11 tribes, and there are services for victims of domestic violence in all of those counties and in all 11 tribes. So we are very fortunate, and if you yourself are a victim of domestic abuse or know someone who's a victim, you may find the services by county on our website, which is www.endabusewi.org. going to our website and clicking on Get Help will help you find by county which programs exist. They all offer, almost all of them offer 24-hour helplines. They're available, they're free, they're confidential.
Yeah, a wonderful, wonderful service. Jeanette in Waukesha, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hello, yes. I thank you for taking my call. I have a daughter I am extremely concerned about. I just really don't know where to turn to ask somebody for help for her because she doesn't want the help. She has a traumatic brain injury from the abuse she has suffered. She's hidden the abuse from me. Matter of fact, my grandson told me. And I just really would like to know, how do I go about trying to help her when she is now trying to say that I am the source of her problems?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Jeanette, I can really hear your pain, and I'm really sorry for the situation that you're in. I want to say to you that the main thing that you can do is gain information for yourself. As I mentioned just a few minutes before you came on, there are services in all communities, and there are services in your community. Those are available to victims, but also available to family and friends. A really good place to go and call and ask for support and help and understanding and increasing your own knowledge. Now, I know you also want help for her. And the biggest...
I'm worried about my grandson.
Yeah, I hear that. I so hear it.
I am. I really am.
So some of the things that I think are really critical for you to think about is one of the things that happens so clearly for many people who are in a violent relationship is that they become very isolated, and they feel very much how much people are judging them if they suspect or know about the violence. So what becomes really critical for you is to remain a lifeline for her, to, to simply say to her, you know, I'm worried for you and I'm worried for your safety and the safety of your kids. But I'm understanding that you don't want to make a decision right now, but I want you to know that I'm always here for you. And I'm here for you in a way that will not ever judge you for the decisions that you're making. And I know that's a hard thing to say when you're so deeply concerned. But if you think about it from a perspective of trying to help break the isolation that she is experiencing, that many of her friends, if she works, her coworkers may suspect, and she is both being isolated by him from those people and also isolating herself because she doesn't, it's an embarrassing thing. It's a scary thing. Leaving is hard. It's a big decision.
Right.
And people have to do it in their own time. And so she needs
her family fragmented.
Right. And she needs to know who
she's concerned about.
Right. She needs to know who will be there for her unconditionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a really important role that you can play as her mom.
Need to know who to alert because I am more concerned. She is distancing herself from me. I took care of my grandson for the last 10 years. I have always been there for my daughter. It's now the injury is so bad to her and from the abuse from her own father not being in a part of her life. I've been a single parent, and she's 31 years old. She's a professional. She owns a home. I think she's more afraid of not having that because of a child being involved, that there's somebody else there to help care for him, that there's, you know what I'm saying, so she can get to work, that there isn't an interruption in her livelihood. And she has a very stressful job as well, where she is relied on by other people.
So there's a lot going on there.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, really, again, I'm going to stress for you, Jeanette, that you should reach out to the program in your community and make a connection there with them so you can understand the resources that are available, that you can get support for yourself, and that when she's ready, she can understand, you know, you can say, you can share with her what resources are available. And it's a very difficult thing to do because I hear so much that you want the violence to stop and you want to intervene, and it's really painful to know that this is happening. But she's an individual and she's got to make the decisions for herself. Mm-hmm. And the thing I always recognized in my many years of working with victims of domestic violence is that they always know things about leaving or staying. Their own guts tell them whether or not it's safe for them to go or to stay. And that many victims, after they've finally broken free, will say, I knew I was in danger, but I felt like I would be in danger more if I left, and I knew I needed to be very strategic about when I chose to leave. You know, you have to remember that although there are shelters that exist, we have about 50, we have 70 programs in all 72 counties, about 50 shelters across the state. Making a decision to leave and to go into a shelter, walking away from everything you own, is a really big decision. It is a big decision on many levels, disrupting your child's school, all of that. And victims are taking into account the complexity of the situation for themselves and are really often trying to be strategic. And she may not be able to tell you that, but I can assure you that she is doing what she believes she needs to do to survive.
A traumatic brain injury, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hear. Yeah.
I hope you will seek out these local, and again, just to repeat, and for others that may, what kind of local services do exist?
Well, there are services in all counties. There is not a shelter in every county, but there are services available in all counties. We have 72 counties. There are about 50 shelters, but domestic violence services, counselors, staff who can help people with legal issues, do legal advocacy, help guide people through restraining order processes, or help them understand what's involved in filing a police report, are available in all 72 counties in Wisconsin.
Jeanette, good luck. Thank you very much for calling in. We're certainly all thinking about you and pulling for you, and especially for your daughter and your grandson. Good luck. Keith in Dodgeville, I want to give you a chance to join in. Keith, hello. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. Tough subject.
Yes.
I was wondering if the guest is aware of the book that President Jimmy Carter, is evidently writing on this subject from a world perspective. He had evidently decided it was one of the main things that needed to be addressed around the world in terms of human rights, and he got together religious leaders from all around the world and different countries, and did surveys and talked with these people, and is now writing a book about their conclusions, which evidently are going to be rather deeply controversial. But I was wondering if your guest was aware of that.
I was not aware that he's writing that book, and I will research it immediately upon returning to my office. I'm very intrigued. I had the honor of attending last year the United States. Every 5 years, there's a global conference of it's called the World Conference of Women's Shelters, and it was located in the United States last year. And it was a fascinating conference to attend. There were more than 2,000 advocates there from across the entire globe, and realizing the commonality that we all share, that violence in relationships is a universal truth across cultures and many and in all countries. I was really particularly struck by, I went to the presentation by the Icelandic women's coalition, and that Norway is supposedly the most gender equitable country in the world. And she talked about the fact that they're known for gender equity, yet domestic violence exists tremendously, and that women tend to be the greater victims of domestic abuse, even in a country that has so universally stressed gender equity.
Mm.
Yeah, one of the things that they were, it started out from a point of view of how can religion and religious leaders help deal with this, and they ended up, at least most of them, agreeing that religion had a relationship to this that was maybe not what a lot of people expected in terms of the rates of domestic abuse, or at least female domestic abuse, in different countries around the world. So it's evidently going to be fairly disturbing.
Yeah, it sounds very intriguing. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you, Keith, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, if you have a question, comment, experience to share. I hope you will, at 1-800-642-1234. We have an email from Calvin, who said he was raised by manic alcoholic women, more than one. So he says domestic violence can go both ways because of the lack of support for men. I'm too old to learn any different and prefer living alone. I feel safer this way.
Well, what I want to stress for Calvin is that, I acknowledged right off the bat that men are victims of domestic violence as well, and that all of those programs in all of Wisconsin's 72 counties and actually across the nation serve both women and men. So services do exist for men. All the programs are serving them, not in the high numbers as they're serving women, but many men do come forward and seek services and support for themselves. The programs are helping men who have children who have fled an abusive relationship. We also know that violence occurs in all relationships in our society, and that in LGBTQ relationships, domestic violence can occur. So we see both men and women coming forward for services and seeking support.
What are some of the warning signs of an abusive relationship?
I would say probably the number one warning sign is control. Often far before physical violence occurs, victims describe feeling controlled by a person. And sometimes the control is hard to recognize immediately. But I often say to many victims have told me tales of the meeting a person who just loved them so immensely, wanted to spend every minute of their time together, didn't want them to go out with their friends because they were so in love that they wanted them to spend all of their time with each other. Many victims have talked about their partner as sort of taking over their life, saying to them, you don't need a job, you can move in with me, your kids can move in with me. And I often say to people, when all of that's happening in the first month or two, if it feels too good to be true, it probably is. In today's society, it would be rare for somebody to take on somebody so quickly. And what many victims have talked about is they fell into that trap thinking this person loves me so much. He wants to spend all of his time with me, wants me to move in with him, says I can quit my job and he'll support me financially. All of that very much controls the victim when they look back on it. Later, hindsight being 2020, often see that as very controlling and very isolating. I talked with Jeanette about the need to really keep the lines of communication open so as to not allow that isolation to occur.
Barb in Black River Falls, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. We recently had a very tragic murder here. A 20-year-old son killed his father. And a couple days before that, the father was talking to my son saying, I don't know what to do with him. He's isolating himself. And so I want people to know that just because it's not always between man and woman, it can be between parents, that there's domestic violence.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, adult, and when we're talking about children killing their parents, it's more commonly sons killing parents, often elder parents. And there's very similar dynamics that can occur in those relationships. And it is extraordinarily tragic. I don't know much about the situation that you're speaking about. I don't know if mental illness was a factor. It sounds like the son was isolating himself. That's around the age that if mental illness is going to appear, often does. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's mm-hmm. mental illness that caused this, but I'm wondering if that may have been
an
element.
That was a combination with drugs because they did find some drug paraphernalia. And it was a very, very brutal murder, and hopefully somebody can prevent something like this happening in the future.
Right. And in small communities like Black River Falls, everybody probably knew those two people. It was probably extraordinarily painful. Thank you for...
He was at my son's wedding.
Barb, thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing.
For sharing that. I appreciate it very much. I want to give Kenny in Wausau a chance to participate. Kenny, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Appreciate your call.
Good. Well, I think it's great that there's shelters for these women, all right? But in February, my cousin was killed in St. Paul, Minnesota. There, I'm sure you've heard of Kira Steger. And they're burying her Saturday. Her body was found in the Mississippi River. Her husband was found guilty. I'm also saying that, you know, some of these women's shelters, I went through a situation about 10 years ago where my girlfriend and I were breaking up and she accused me of abuse. I went to jail and sat 110 days before the charges were dismissed. And I had alibis. I subpoenaed 26 people to court. But every time I turned around, you know, and I could prove where I was and that, you know, this never happened, they would change the date on it.
So here's somebody, thanks, Kenny, for calling, somebody who's had a kind of a pretty terrible experience.
Yeah, I'm sorry that happened for you, Kenny. And I know sorry doesn't go very far when you've sat for 3 months in jail as well. What I will say is that false reporting does occur. It occurs in domestic violence and sexual assault at the same rate of false reporting any crimes, about 2%. So, you know... I don't know how to stop that from happening. Most certainly, it's certainly not anything that anyone supports. And I'm glad that you were absolved eventually of the charges.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling, Kenny. I want to give James and Siren a chance to join in, too, as we're kind of getting short of time here. James, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My only comment is, like, the services, at least up here, need to somehow either be a little bit more visible or reach out maybe at least to high-profile type victims. I was assaulted by my female partner in 2012, and I should have probably been one of the statistics of 2012. And after that happened, I had to search extremely hard to find any kind of help up here, mm-hmm. and I found it to be totally inadequate, what I did find.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost more victimizing going through the process of trying to find people and just getting more phone numbers and people putting me, you know, I'm going to give you this person or that person.
Yeah.
It was just very hard to find any kind of
help. Yeah.
Sure. What I will say is, obviously, as I said before, there are services in all 72 counties. But what I will say is the challenge for those services is in particularly northwest Wisconsin, the county size is large. Those services are often covering 3,000 square miles of service area, and their budgets are quite small. And so they're doing as much as they can with very little financial resources. The concept of them advertising or outreach is impossible for them to even think about. They don't have budgets that would even allow that to happen. So, you know, services do exist there, though, and they're 24-hour services. You can find them on our website under Get Help, www.endabusewi.org. And I'm sorry that it was so difficult for you to find the support you needed, James.
And I'm sorry that we're out of time. We've so many things that we could still have talked about here that we weren't able to just because we ran out of time, Patty. So I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
We
should discuss this again. Patty Seeger, Executive Director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Go to my Facebook page for links that are helpful in this area. Stay with us.